ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making
its One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Remember the budget?
This budget includes the most significant tax reform package.
It taxed income from capital gains as income, like your wage income, like my wage income, albeit with a discount for inflation, removing for most investments the rule that saw only half of each capital gain taxed, until an avalanche of complaints day after day, many of them more like niggles than complaints. We appreciate what you're trying to do, but could you just exempt or soften it for startups, for small businesses, and then a partial back down?
The next steps that we announced today are all about providing more clarity and confidence to investors, more support for small businesses, and more incentives for innovation.
So where are we now? What remains of the most significant tax reform in a quarter of a century? And what does what happened to it tell us about how hard it is these days to change anything, no matter how much we appreciate what the government's trying to do? Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest this week, Parliament House gumshoe Patrick Commons, who's currently economics editor for The Guardian after working as economics correspondent for The Australian and economics writer for The Australian Financial Review. He's been following those manoeuvrings in Parliament day by day, as I have, and those headlines. Wrecking ball, drive-by shooting, uninvestable, brain drain, war on aspiration. And Graham Samuel, a business figure who's headed both the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry and the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, and much more besides, and is in a very good position to judge what happens when governments try to change things, having played, as you'll hear, an important role in the creation of the Goods and Services Tax. Welcome, Graham, and welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, Peter. Good to be talking with you.
Hi, Peter.
Patrick, what was the government trying to do? What did it say it was trying to do in the budget?
Well, it was trying to make it easier for people to own their first home. That was a big selling point. They were trying to cut taxes for workers, and that was part of the overall deal as well. And to get there, they were going to better align the tax treatment of asset and labour income. So the money you make from working and the money you make from selling assets, selling a property, selling shares, to make sure that the tax treatment of the two was more fair.
So you had been taxed on only half of each capital gain. If you bought something at one price, sold it later at another, you'd been taxed on only half of the gain. What's the change they tried to put in place?
Effectively, what they want to do is they want to make sure that they are taxing you on the real gains from the sale of your assets rather than the nominal. So it should be a more nuanced, a more exact way to tax capital gains.
That's not the only change they made. And of course, they did that because there were a lot of investors diving into housing and I suppose elbowing owner-occupiers out at auctions and so on. The other change they made was to impose a minimum tax of 30% on real gains. What was the thinking behind that?
They're trying to treat the income from capital and wages equally again, and they're trying to avoid people selling assets at a time when their income's very low. So usually, you know, when you hold on to your investment property or properties, for example, for a number of years, and then you don't sell it until you've finished work when your income is very low. So they're trying to address that.
It looks as if their political mistake was not to stop at housing. They applied these measures to all assets, including shares and including startups. And that's been the source of most of the criticism, those headlines I read out. Why do you think they didn't simply stop at housing?
You don't want people making decisions around, oh, I'll invest in shares rather than property because I can get a better tax deal on shares. They don't want to get into this situation where they are distorting decisions based on tax. They want people to make the decision based on what they think, you know, is the best place to invest their money.
And it brought an avalanche of criticism. Mm. Graham, you've seen the reaction to those changes. I read out some of the headlines. Is it the reaction you would have expected? And does it mean the government's on the wrong track?
No, it's exactly the reaction that I expected from vested interests. Always happens, whatever reform you're dealing with. I could have written the script myself, but I think what Patrick just summarised is very, very interesting. If I can take three or four words out of it. One was to remove the distortions, and that ought to be a fundamental criteria of tax reform. The second one is one of equity, trying to treat people the same way, whatever they do. And then the third element that he mentioned was you make your decisions as to what you do on the basis of what you think is going to be the best outcome for you, freed from the distortion caused by, you know, various, you know, tax processes. Let me give you a very real example. Just a little while ago, I unfortunately had to have a complete knee replacement. And I said to the surgeon, after he'd finished, you know, what was a really important and a difficult bit of surgery, I said, tell me, do you have a 50% reduction in tax for what you've just done to my knee? And he looked at me puzzled and then laughed. I said the same thing to the anaesthetist. I said, you were paid to keep me alive and to wake up from the operation. And again, he looked at me with wonderment and then just laughed. Why is it that people who are earning income through personal exertion, and I earn it through PAYG, why is it that I've got to be subsidising by paying a full rate of tax, subsidising those who invest in capital? It's a distortion that we shouldn't be putting into the system. The problem is you put it into the system, it's very difficult to get rid of it because people get used to the feather bedding.
You said people get used to the feather bedding. Before we went on air, you shared with me an equation that you're even going to share with the senators. I know that we don't normally use equations on The Economy Stupid, but it is called The Economy Stupid. What was the equation?
Oh, it's a very simple one, and that is that the louder the noise is in inverse proportion to the public interest being served by the reform, right? So if you like, R, that is reform, equals I over V, that is vested interests.
So you would actually see this reaction, and there's scarcely been a day without a headline about some aspect of this offending someone. You would see this as a sign. In fact, if this wasn't happening, you'd be thinking perhaps that the reform wasn't much of a reform.
Well, that's right. And look, the one that I actually chuckled over for a long time and then started to really wonder what was going on was in one of the daily newspapers, the front page of which had a photo of a business person who said that he was putting his enterprise into voluntary administration because of the tax reforms. And I thought, mate, these reforms aren't even in Parliament yet. You're saying that your business has collapsed because of the tax reforms. But the worst of it was that the media outlet, a significant newspaper in Australia, put this on the front page without the slightest exposure of the hypocrisy and the irony of what was being claimed by the business person concerned.
Patrick, what have been the complaints of entrepreneurs, startups, people who invent companies, and what did the government promise in return?
They begin their business just in their garage, nothing but their hard work. They buy a laptop, but that's pretty much it. So essentially, it's just their hard work, ingenuity, and entrepreneurship, and then they turn this, you know, from their bedroom or garage, they turn it into a huge business and everyone's happy with it. Now, what they're saying with the new inflation-linked method of calculating CGT, they say, hold on a second, our costs are zero. How are we going to index, how are we going to reflect inflation when we go to sell this if our original costs are zero?
So, do you mean they might be taxed as much as I am after years, a decade?
Yes. But you can see that there is, you know, there is an issue there. If you're saying you were going to inflation link your cost base and they're saying, well, our cost base is a zero, how is that going to work? So it's one of those things which is a reasonable issue to raise. So what the government has done is they have said, well, okay, if you are the founder of and wait for it, this, we've got to put this in quotation marks because it's going to be something which I'm sure people talk about in the future, is genuinely innovative. If you're a genuinely innovative startup with a very low zero cost base, alongside your early investors and your employees who get paid with shares in the business, then you'll be able to stick with the 50% flat capital gains tax discount. You'll have that option.
So if you're genuinely innovative, you'll be taxed at half the rate I am, whereas the complaint was that income from capital gains from selling a company, which I suppose in that case is largely delayed wage income.
Absolutely, yeah.
The complaint was that it would be taxed as wages. The government has also increased the number of small businesses that get the special even lower rate. Done a separate deal with the Greens on the self-managed super funds. They'll no longer be able to borrow to buy property. That was recommended in the Financial System Review. Graham, I'm wondering whether there's a danger that exempting here, exempting there, it's a bit like, you know, if you're trying to level a table with four legs and you shave a bit off one leg and you shave, after a while you end up with the table on the floor. I'm wondering if there's a danger you end up complicating things. Bob Brunick, head of the Tax and Transfer Institute at the ANU, we had him on the program. He made the point in his submission that one of the core rationales of the reform is to remove the incentive to change your structure to, in this case, I suppose, become genuinely innovative or define yourself in some way, and that creating carve-outs undermines that objective. Is this what we can see happening before our eyes, that something starts out intending to be universal and ends up, I suppose, being eaten away?
Look, I think that's exactly the problem that occurs with carve-outs. By the way, I'm involved in several startups. I wish that they had no cost base. One of the biggest problems you have with startups is to actually get investors to put money in to be able to pay for the cost base. So I have a heavy doubt and a cynicism about the suggestion that startups have no cost. Keep in mind that some of these startups do convert into very, very valuable companies. And if we want to avoid some of the distortions that occur through that, then we have to subject that wealth to an appropriate, equitable, fair tax imposition. And that's what Chalmers has done.
Well, should we be concerned about the talk that entrepreneurs, presumably at the stage when they're beginning the startup, would leave the country, start up a business in New Zealand, which doesn't have a capital gain, or the Silicon Valley, which has a very large capital gains tax, larger than ours?
Well, good luck to them. Look, people choose to invest in Australia and to make capital investments or startup investments, the case may be, because they find the environment is right, not only for the investment, but also for their style of living and a whole range of other factors. And so for those that say they're going to leave, and I read it every day in one national newspaper, this one's leaving, that one's going to leave, et cetera. And I think to myself, I'd love to be able to audit the reasons for their supposed departure, like the character who launched into voluntary administration of his business because of the tax reforms, which didn't even exist at this stage.
Is there a broader argument, though, Graham, that capital is scarce, or it's said to be scarce, and that Australia needs a lower rate of tax on capital because it is scarce and needed, and otherwise people making capital gains, I suppose, would buy and sell properties or shares overseas or move overseas?
Yeah. Well, if that argument is the one that's made by those that are investing in capital and have enjoyed the feather bedding of the 50% discount on tax rate that's been in there since it was introduced many, many years ago. And they'll always say that. And I'm willing to bet my bottom dollar, which is nothing like as deep as some of these entrepreneurs, but I'd like to bet my bottom dollar that in a year's time or 2 years' time, we'll say, well, what was all the fuss about? It's made very little difference. See, we might need capital investment, but we also need more surgeons and more anaesthetists and more plumbers and more electrical contractors to be able to build houses and builders and the like. But we don't give them the tax concession that we give to capital. So you've got to ask, what is it that motivated our politicians of yesteryear to suddenly say we need capital more than we need people that are being paid a salary or that are being paid a professional income for doing whatever they're doing?
Another argument, Patrick, which we have heard is that capital, money you use to buy something at one price, sell it for a profit later, is already taxed because it's taxed as income. And this argument has something of an impressive lineage. A UK tax review considered it and found in favour of it, although the UK government didn't. Australia's tax review, the Henry tax review, acknowledged it. It's that these people who make capital gains are making them on money that has already been taxed.
Yeah, I mean, this is an idea that you shouldn't simply tax savings. You shouldn't make it a disincentive to save money rather than spend money. But I mean, I would argue that this is what an inflation-linked approach to capital gains tax gets towards, right? I mean, that is moving in that direction. You know, I don't think we're moving any further away in moving it towards an inflation-linked. I would have thought that that's kind of a more accurate representation of the time value of money by linking it to inflation.
Accurate representations of what we're about here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guest this week, Guardian Australia Economics Editor Patrick Commons, and Graham Samuel, who is head of the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, was instrumental in developing the changes that gave us the goods and services tax, mere years after it had been decisively rejected at an election and a Prime Minister had declared it dead, buried and cremated. Graham, I want you to take us back to Australia's last successful attempt at tax reform. As you've told it to me, I like this story because I was a small part of it, it began in a radio studio, three ABC studios actually, connected by landlines. You were in one of them. Can you tell me, this was 1996, can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, well, I'd just been elected as president of the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, which at that time represented about 37 different business organisations throughout Australia. And prior to this radio interview you're talking about, I'd been on Meet the Press with Paul Bongiorno. And he saw me in the green room before and he said, Graham, is there a question you'd like me to ask? I said, yeah, ask me about tax. Paul, the current income tax system is stuffed. Some people objected to the use of that word, but I said, it's completely stuffed. I said, it's inequitable. It's capable of being avoided very, very easily. We've got to go for a goods and services tax or a consumption tax. That became a bit of a headline. And then I took it up and I thought, well, why not? Let's have a go. And I spoke to Rob Fitzgerald of the Australian Council of Social Services.
He was in one of the studios that I described, and you were in another. I was in another. I think it was Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra. After the conclusion of the debate, as I remember, you two were talking really well. And I said, look, I'll just let you keep talking. I walked out of the studio, edited the story, and you two kept chatting.
Yeah. And in fact, Peter, the fact that you walked out of the studio was very, very useful because we were no longer constrained by having some radio interviewer or whatever, listening to what we were saying. But we talked then about what we would do to be able to have the two organisations, one representing business right around the country, the other representing social services. And I said, look, why don't we adopt the fundamental theme that we need a less distortive, a much more equitable, a much fairer tax system that can't be avoided? And he said he agreed. He was concerned about there being a reduction of taxes, a percentage of GDP. I said, look, we can deal with that and we'll accept the base level, which I think was at that time 24%. But I said on one condition, and that is that we subject current expenditure to a proper rigorous analysis to make sure that we're not spending money inappropriately. And so we agreed. And then the two of us went away and we secured the support, I might say, at that stage of our organisations. Now, I don't know what Rob had to do with ACOS, but I went before the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry group, the 37 members, and said, this is what we have agreed in principle to do with Rob Fitzgerald of ACOS. One of those present then said to me, he was highly critical, he said, why would you ever do this with ACOS? I said, because it's no use taking tax reform forward representing just the business community. It is doomed to failure. You've got to have the whole community involved. That is, focus on the public interest. Well, that's what we did. I have to say that the individual concerned apologised after our tax summit, which was in October 1996, and he said, Graham, you were right. And I appreciate the fact that you proceeded with commitment and determination to do this. But there was a really important thing that occurred, which was this tech summit in October 1996. We drew together 100 different organisations. We said it was a politician and public service free environment. The 100 delegates at that meeting in the National Press Club in Canberra all voted unanimously in favour of proposing a broad-based consumption tax or goods and services tax. And we then set up a very small committee or forum involving both business and social services and the like. The only people we couldn't get to be involved was the ACTU, and I tried my darndest with Bill Kelty to do that, but unfortunately they were stuck in a political environment that wouldn't allow it. And would you believe the Business Council refused to be involved? In fact, they banned one of their members from attending the forum.
So we had your business organisation, the Chamber of Commerce, pushing this in the Business Council and the, I suppose we had Symmetry, and the trade union movement being sceptical of the consensus that you were developing.
No, they were more than sceptical. They were resisting it. They were recalcitrant. So we proceeded to work on this. There was some courage involved, obviously, but also with communication. And I often like to say, as I said in the Senate, I love the C word. People get taken aback when I say that. I said the C word in this area is commitment, courage, and communication. And what I think the Prime Minister and the Treasurer have shown now in this context has been commitment and courage. And I'm not quite sure about the communication, but it is very, very difficult to communicate highly complex tax reform to people who, frankly, are not that interested in it. They just know they pay their tax each month or each year, as the case may be. Unless they've got a strong vested interest, they don't really understand what it's about. And I've had some eye-opening experience of that over recent days, just of people misunderstanding what it is that Treasurer Chalmers has put forward.
Patrick, does this sound like it was a quarter of a century ago? Does it sound like it was from another era? How does that sort of gel with what we've been seeing? We had a productivity summit last year. We've had the odd tax discussion. How does that sort of process sound? Can you even conceive of it happening today?
Look, I think, listen to Graham there. You do wonder about the process and how this has come to be. There is an argument, and I suspect that politics were a big part of it, that they haven't properly gone through a process. And that level of frustration, I think, is visible from people from the kind of vested interests that Graham's talking about before, but also about, independent, just want the best outcome, people like, David Pocock.
Is it partly, though, do you think, Patrick, that we have... I'll ask you, Graham, actually, did we have a culture of complaint then?
We've got to recognise that the pleas divide into two categories. One, the plea is that if you go ahead with this, then the world will collapse, right? The sun won't rise tomorrow. The second plea is, why don't we subject this to a proper inquiry on a new white paper that the Business Council might want or whatever it might be? That is designed to do two things. One, to delay. Vested interest tried on every time. And that's why I admire what the Treasurer has done here. And he said, look, we've had enough discussion. We've had the Henry paper, Ken Henry's paper of years ago. There's been so much discussion about this. What I'm going to do now is to introduce reform that is designed to be equitable, it's designed to be fair, it's designed to remove distortions. It's also designed, I've been bemused at the fact that we have been complaining in the media for months and months now, if not years, about how housing has become unaffordable for new home buyers. So the Treasury introduces reforms that are going to make it easier. And of course, what happens is the investors are driven out of the market, which is good for new home buyers. And would you believe prices are leveling out, even falling by 1 or 2%. And suddenly the complaint is there that clearance rates are at their lowest level for a long time, and that house prices are, quotes, plummeting, close quotes. No, that's not happening.
I just wanted to ask Graham, actually, because one of the things with the media coverage of this, and having obviously been a reporter for quite a while, if you have a room of 1,000 people and, you tell them a new tax rule and it only affects 10 of those people, like 1% of those people, and they start screaming, Now, the way kind of we have a couple of, you know, national newspapers, they won't go and ask every single person, what do you think, and then report on it. They go straight to those 10 people and you end up with, you know, story after story after story, and it looks like this is a massive deal, but it's only really affecting 1% of people. Now, this is just an example. Now, is this the same when, you know, if you look back on when, you know, you were involved in these reforms, was it a similar thing, or is it different now? Because there's this idea that it's harder because of the way media has been splintered and polarized to get these big broad reforms across.
No, it's I don't think it's any harder. It's the complexity that hits us. But I grew numbed to all this when I headed up the National Competition Council, which was vested with the responsibility of introducing national competition policy reforms. And what I did at the time was to give many speeches that said, vested interests will always march up and down the street with, you know, loud megaphones and big placards opposing the changes. The problem is that the public interest is rarely represented in those marches.
A quick final question to each of you. If this had failed, if this hadn't become law, would the opportunity for future tax reform have been set way, way back, Patrick?
Yeah, I think it would have been. I think it's fair to say. And I think, you know, going back to what Graham was saying earlier, they do need to push these things through. And I understand the haste and the rush and this kind of feeling that we need to take this opportunity to make what is a meaningful reform and will make a meaningful difference, hopefully, to some of the problems that we've all been talking about in the tax system for a very long time. Of course, it's still, you know, early days, and we'll need to, you know, see how this plays out in the next year and then ultimately at the next election. But I think this is a positive sign that we can get reform done in this country after years of complaining that maybe we can't.
Are you now optimistic, Graham, not necessarily about any particular reform, but about the prospect for future reforms?
I think this government is actually showing itself as having the courage and the commitment to undertake reform. So, yeah, some successes they've had: superannuation a year ago, the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act on November the 27th last year. Now this. Now, if we do all that, that's a clear signal to the government and to the more courageous ministers there. If you've got serious reform, undertake it. You can get it through, and it's not the end of government.
So there may be exciting things to come.
I hope so. I hope so.
Hopefully even better explained. Graham, Patrick, briefly before we go, as is traditional on the program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Patrick.
I think the big thing that's going to be happening here once the tax legislation settles down, it'll be interesting to see how the debates roll out. Some of these things are a big deal when they're introduced, and then people kind of forget about them when they realise the world hasn't ended. But I think the really interesting thing to look out for here is what's going to be happening with the NDIS. It's going to be really hard, and I think it's so critical also to what they want to do in terms of their agenda and the budget and their fiscal position, that this is just going to be an incredibly important thing in the next, in the next year.
Graham.
You know, politically, and responding to Patrick there, I agree, the NDIS is the next one. And politically, it is probably ironically quite smart to enter into an eight-week study of the NDIS reforms, because what it does, we get these tax reforms into place, hopefully in the next 2 weeks, and then the next focus will be on the NDIS. And suddenly that'll be the headlines. That'll be the thing that will capture people's attention, and the tax reforms will just fade.
Do you know, I remember 1985, I was actually in the room for the final press conference at that tax summit. The talk about the things that were going to end. Property investment was going to end because of the capital gains tax, and restaurants were going to end. We weren't going to dine out because they were going to have a fringe benefits tax. And as I remember, it didn't take many months at all until life went on as it had. Graham Samuel, a former head of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission and the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, Guardian Australia Economics Editor Patrick Commons, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us. Many of you have done that about last week's program via the economy.stupid@abc.net.au. Brilliant is one of the words used. The thesis was that the time we're living through now is more like the 1930s than any other time. Thanks to producer Rebecca Metcalf. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.